a poem by Michael Crummy. Consider the earnestness of pavement, its dark, elegant sheen after rain, its insistence on leading you somewhere. A highway wants to own the landscape. It sections prairies into neat squares, swallows mile after mile of countryside to connect the dots of cities and towns, to make sense of things. A river is less opinionated, less predictable. It never argues with gravity. Its history is a series of delicate negotiations with time and geography. Wet your feet all you want. It's never the river you remember. A road repeats itself incessantly, obsessed with its own small truth. It wants you to believe in something particular. The destination you have in mind when you set out is nowhere you have ever been. Where you arrive finally depends on how you get there, by river or by road. So welcome everyone to one of the talks, I can't remember what the number is now, of the series of the five fears stretched into six fears and seven talks. Compute the math on that. And tonight is the sort of the odd fear that isn't covered in the five fears spoken about in Buddhism, and that's. But I wanted to speak about it because I think it's such a relevant one, and that's the fear to love, the fear to love. As we were commuting from home up to this church, it was sunset, and we were passing much of the traffic that was heading home from work. And there was one bicyclist that had stopped on the bridge and had dismounted and was just looking across at the sunset, taking it in, not so interested in continuing his commute, but just pausing, taking that pause and just taking in the beauty of what he was seeing. And I thought, oh, that's a perfect example of the talk tonight. It's a perfect example of the poem I read, really. The pavement or the river? The pavement or the river? The mind or the heart? Let's phrase it that way. Or, in terms of the topic of the series, fear or love? Fear or love? You see, there's an inherent clash, conflict that must arise between the mind and the heart, between fear and love. And the sense of ourselves, the egoic sense of ourselves, the sense that embodies itself in image, that has a deep historical tie to its past, his or her past, and has a lot at stake in terms of anticipation and hope in the future. That embodiment of self that is really the focus of Buddhism has to come in conflict with that which is fluid, open, unknown, undetermined, that ambles rather than is a forced direction of the pavement. That which doesn't really have a purpose, as opposed to the purposefulness of our mental action. And that conflict is really what we call a spiritual journey. That rub, that friction that has to arise when our whole life has been framed in terms of pavement, and yet our whole heart and body yearns for that which is fluid, which is natural, which is authentic, which is present. And so as we speak about this fear, the fear to love, we're really speaking about that friction. I don't think there's a subject that scares us more deeply. And however we define love than this one. And we can see the culmination of that friction when we get into relationships. And I'll speak about romantic relationships now, but and in no way denies other aspects of relationships, friendships, etc. Because the purpose, or the original purpose, for this culture to come together is based usually in some sense of affection for one another. Now, that's not true for other cultures, but it seems to be the basis for this one. And so the outspoken definition of why we come together in a romantic relationship is that there is some affection, some love, something that one person ignites in us that we perceive originating from that other person rather than from us, which is a mistake already. And we say we're in love. In love. And then, inevitably, the minds come into play. So there can't, I don't know of a single relationship, and please raise your hand if you're in one, in which your mind hasn't come into play in within the definition of that romantic quality, within the definition of why you got together, which is love. So you can see the boiling point and the crisis. Is that the heart is yearning for some sense of bonding and completion and connection, and the mind works in overdrive to prevent that from occurring. And that's the paradox of relationship. We're scared to death of it. Because it means losing ourselves. It's losing our representation, our embodiment, when we release ourselves into the intimacy of that connection, true bonding. And so the mind finds excuses in every way to object, to judge, to distance, to keep a distance in the very relationship that was there to bring us together. It's so interesting when you see it this way. And everybody has, many of us have done workshops in which we try to work out the mind's inevitable desire to keep that division. But it's inherent. You can give up the mind, but how many of us are willing to do that? That's what all spirituality is about. But that's really at the crux of what the origins of marriage were about, the lighting from two candles of one single one. That single sense of coming together and releasing ourselves from the individual identities into the single identity that is now the couple, rather than the individuals. And the reason I think that many of us have such a feared relationship to affection and intimacy is not only that we have an intimation that if we go in this direction, it's going to mean something. Some way I'm going to have to give up something. Right? And that's exactly what you have to do in a relationship. You have to give up. You have to release. You have to let go. We have to let go, don't we? That's what makes a relationship work, is that each person in the relationship is willing to release their demands upon it. Well, that is exactly the spiritual journey. It's just magnified in this particular dimension of romantic relationship, but it's exactly the spiritual journey. And therefore, relationships can be, if they're used in the right way, can be an enormous facilitation of our spiritual journey. But most of them don't, we don't use that way. We're too full of complaint and judgment, either self-complaint and judgment, or the complaint about our partner. We just didn't choose right. Whatever. But in any case, okay, so now I'm going to put the romantic relationship beside, but you get a sense, you get a feeling for its potential, and that's what I wanted to show you, that there's no aspect of our human existence that doesn't hold that same potential if we use it. So what we have learned from our history with being in relationships and other love-orientated ways that we have lived is that love is not safe, that it in fact is untrustworthy. And in fact, we have to monitor it to keep it sane and to keep it predictable and to keep it paved. We have to pave the waters of love. And so most of us aren't willing to relax into this subject. We keep making demands on it. In fact, what we mostly do is try to control it. That's how that's the only way the mind knows to respond to the lack of trust, is that it hasn't been trustworthy in the past. I still want it for some reason, which I don't really know, but my whole body is pulled towards it. Spiritual dimension and physical dimension. I mean, it's really like the opposite sides of two magnets, or the north and south pole. I mean, it's more than just sexuality. It's a deep yearning. It's a space that is relatively safe for a deep yearning to be met. But then we just keep butchering that magnetism, because we don't trust it. We fear it. We fear it, really. I mean, and we think the way to make it trustworthy is to be dominant, to play forth our dominance. And many relationships are really fostered in domination. Domination is an attempt of the mind to care. It's the best we can do. I mean, I have a very dear friend who has a daughter, and once in a while we go over to our friend's home, and the young daughter is, you know, she's not as disciplined as her older sister, and she's not as astute and study and not as intellectually competent. But she's her own self, and she's a beautiful young 16-year-old. And the mother, my friend, is just... She cares. I know in her heart she cares about her daughter. I know the maternal link is there. But the way that care is expressed is in terms of domination. Get back to your homework. You cannot watch, you know, just constant, like riding, you know, like you're going to break this pony, this wild horse. You're going to break it down so it's rideable, so that it'll stay within the fashion. And it's terrible to see. She, if you spoke with her, would say that I would talk about the caring quality. that she feels in relationship to her domination. And this need to control is because we don't trust it. We don't trust that people will turn all out all right if you can leave them alone. In fact, think of what it was like when we were children. You didn't want your parents butchering you with demands all the time. In fact, I knew, and I'm sure you did as well, you had a sense of morality and ethics. We didn't need that constant hammering. And we often acted out because of it. And some of us got into drugs and other things during those years of the 60s. And now I'm seeing the parents of those kids who grew up through the 60s being afraid that their children are going to run into the same things that they ran into and inserting the same causes of why they ran into it onto their children. Now, does this make sense? Using the same mechanism of control to steer their kids in the right direction, even though it didn't work for them. In fact, it was the very steering that led us into the acting out. We don't learn the lessons. We just pass on the damage. So we believe in the power of dominance rather than the power of connecting. Because that's the only way the mind knows to interpret the caring that it feels, which it does feel. The love is still there. The love is there. It's just being distorted by the mind's mistrust. And then, so the themes of mistrust play upon a word, love, which demands complete trust. It can't exist in its full contention, in its full manifestation, through the lens of untrustworthiness, of mistrust. In fact, really what we don't dominate, we really don't trust. See, I know what's best for all of you. Right? Isn't that what we say? I know what's best for you. I know what's best for you. We don't have any real comfort level in relaxing around that. The world just wouldn't work out unless we overseed it. Unless we kept a very sharp vigilance. And that vigilance is necessary because in the past I haven't been, and look what it did to me. But the fact is, the control, when we try to control, it inevitably breaks down. Because when we control someone, even though there may be caring behind the control, the message from the control is that I don't believe in you. Is the negation of the humanness. That's the message. So it has to break down. Has to break down. Either it breaks down the spirit, so that the spirit of the person who is being controlled learns not to trust themselves, or the spirit rises up in anger from the control. It has to do one or the other. And then both sides get angry. Because that's all I know about how to love, is that I I did the best I could. I mean, you ask parents who are well-meaning, they're doing the best they can. And when it breaks down through self-unworthiness in the recipient or through the rising up of anger in the recipient, then I've given you my best. Why are you doing this to me? Haven't I bought you? How could you treat me like this after I've... You see? You have to see that the world made from our mental representation, seen through the eyes of mistrust and control, must be in disarray. Inevitably has to be in disarray. And I mean, you can see the little things. How are we in disarray? If the world is out of control, we're out of control with it. We just we're having some work, minor work. This is minor work. I know it's a minor example, but we're having some work done in our kitchen, and for a week we couldn't use the the kitchen things, and I was very disturbed. Just a little thing. That's like, a little bit of sand in your shoe. But it brings forth this reaction of just being out of control. We have no faith that being out of control can lead to anything but this disarray. What is this ever going... And then the kitchen is complete and we go, isn't this lovely? God, this was so... And you can see why remodeling breaks up relationships. We have no faith in love. And yet, our spiritual journeys calls for that more than anything. Faith in love. Faith in it. And I'll go even further. Devotion to it. Devotion to it. That means you have to be totally present with it. It calls for complete attention, our complete attention, not a hedged attention, not a mistrusting one, I'm okay, 99%, but I'm going to keep out my 1% in case this thing turns against me. I remember when I was in Thailand, some of the creatures around Thailand, the snakes and the centipedes, they could kill a child. These things are pincers on them, and scorpions. And they were like all in my hut. I turn the light off at night and then turn it back on and try to catch them so that they could throw them out so they wouldn't be there when I was sleeping. And at some point, and there was a spider up in the corner of it, which I could never get down, which is the size of my hand. It looked like probably eats geckos. And and always on edge, when everything you hear, it's like, huh. And then finally, you just, I don't know. Maybe I will, and I did. I got stung by the scorpion, and I got stung by a centipede. I didn't get snake bitten. But things did happen. But I lived, and I'm glad I was there. And if I had just relaxed, maybe even those things wouldn't have happened. Because part of the stance I took was the vigilance of violence, which brings forth its alternative. I believe that. No faith. What was the faith? The faith to love. Which means that the sense of me is silent. You see, that's where the screams occur. It's what happens when you tell yourself you're going to sit and find every reason not to. That's the screams of the me. And if we can't handle it at that level, what are we doing? You see, the path of spiritual growth is the path towards into discomfort. Into those screams. If you stay within the realm of the screams, caged within, corralled within the screams, well, you'll die like you are now. And hopefully there needs to be some change along the way, some way that we can invite a deeper sense of ourselves, allowing that deeper sense of ourselves to come out. But that's inevitably going to bring forth the resistance of those screams as love begins to arise. Because what comes out is what's inherent in us, and that's the love. We release the fear we have of the love, and the love arises. It's not like we have to become more loving. We don't. We have to become less fearing. Then the love arises. And it's the confrontation with our fears to love that is the spiritual path, that is the spiritual journey. But if we're not willing to go into the screams, we just are here for a sermon. This is just sermonizing. This is just church service. This is transformation we're doing. This calls forth your reserves, calls forth your willingness to move into the uncomfortable areas of yourself. For love is not sectioned. It's a totality. All aspects. Everything. Everything. We can't have one aspect of ourselves that's cornered and closeted. Which means what? Which means we have to go into our prejudice. We have to bring love into our prejudice. Let us hear this one, because that's what the homework is about. Let us be very clear that prejudice is never about our projected person, group, ethnic, whatever. It's about the fear we have to love ourselves. We feel a certain tendency in ourselves or that we can't love because we've been taught not to. And it's because it's so horribly found within us, the uniqueness, the sexual tendency, or orientation, or whatever, we project it out. And then, safely, we can hate that and onto which we project it out. And then the hate is sectioned off from where it's real, where the real disease lies, and that's the quality in us that we refuse to love. And that's not just, we're not just talking about the huge ones like, you know, Arabs. But whatever problems you're having with anyone, whatever problems we are having with anyone, that's in us because we refuse to love it. It's any strong opinions, any strong reactions that others might bring up in us. And so, okay, I see that. Now, when we see it and begin to understand it, then we move towards the uncomfortable. I'm going to sit, okay? That person is going to stay highlighted with me in terms of his or her presence. I'm going to bring more attention to that presence. I'm going to bring a devoted attention to that presence. I'm going to bring an attention that feels my uncomfortableness, and then I own it, and I just live with that, okay? They're the person. The best thing to do is to sit down with that person and have a conversation, especially if it's a class orientation, like African Americans or homosexuals or something that, you know, is disturbing, generalized, way out beyond the particular and the individual. You sit down with them. Or genders. You know, many, both genders can have an enormous reaction to the other gender if they've had a divorce or a series of traumatic whatever. Which is simply saying that half the population is going to be cut out from my heart. So you sit down. And first you feel the humanity of the connection. Just the humanity. Two people. That all the appearances, all the orientations, that's nothing compared to the humanity, the basis of love meeting love. And the fear and all that, well, what is all of that we hold. How do we hold that? Because this is where the whole thing gets rich and valuable. This is where the mind can't stop it. Unless you give up. You hold it, all the reactivity, in love, in awareness. Awareness and love are, I'm not saying two different words, these are synonyms. So, oh, what is it? What is he thinking of? I don't like it. Oh. You see how the thing, this whole process is predetermined on self-acceptance. How self-acceptance, we has to be there in order for us to progress, releasing the fear, because we have nothing to fall back on. The fear is being generated by us because we're not self-accepting of a particular trait that we want to get rid of and pin on you, on the objected or projected partner or person. So to re-own the symptom, that's the symptom, to re-own, to focus on the symptom, that person is missing the whole of the disease, which is in me, which is non-self-acceptance. And so I have to be able not to try to, beat this thing out, like it's a dent in my fender and I just need to slug it a few times with a sledgehammer. And I'll iron out the curtain. No. Because love doesn't operate in that way. But here's where the trust comes. We have to be so sick of the symptom that we're willing to face the disease with love. And most of us aren't willing to do that. We just keep hammering at the symptom. And what do we bring forth to that sense in ourselves of that feared, what if this really is me? First of all, it is you. So that's the fear is already actualized. What if it's in you? So what? What if it's in you? So what? So what? So what if it's in you? Well, that means I'm a... Yes? What means what? It means nothing. You see, the river doesn't fill in the dots. It doesn't move from city to city. It's not the paved path of straight intention, of definition, of self-image. It's the meandering watercourse way, the fluidity of spirit that says nothing. You see, I think the hardest job for a teacher, a spiritual teacher, is to keep us all in the direction of loving. Because that's not what we've learned culturally, intrapsychically, in relationship. And yet it's the only way. And I hate only ways. When I was a student and somebody would say, I'd get up and leave. Oh, nobody's going to tell me it's the only one. I'll find another. See how angry I was. The silence of the me, the silence, the silent me, the quiet me, the me that parks his or her bike and looks at the sunset, the pausing me, the pausing me, the heartfelt me, heartfelt me, the me of compassion. The me of compassion. It's so easy because compassion is so difficult. You see, all these are expressions of love. We're not saying different things. It hurts when you release your objections to love. What comes in is the pain of the hurt, of connection. Connecting with things, you feel pain. Your own pain as expressed in how the connection is made with other people. And what we like to do is to feign caring, because it hurts too much to genuine care, through moral outrage. That seems to be the way that many of us, especially in the spiritual domain, operate their caring, moral outrage, politically moral outrage, some kind of moral outrage. Homeless, you know, the righteous outrage. But that is feigned caring. We like to set up standards in ourselves of good and bad, and miss the totality of love. People shouldn't do that. We're ready to go right back into our posture of violence at this moment's notice. In the name of spirituality, onward, Christian soldiers. But that's not caring. But it feels good. And you know your place. You got a placeholder there. We know exactly where we are when we're marching off to war. It feels good. It feels justified. But we're missing the totality of love. And we begin to realize that anytime we avoid fear, we block love. Anytime we avoid fear, we're blocking something. And then for a moment, we may actually feel the beauty of connection, the tenderness of compassion, true caring. And because it hurts so much, we go back into self-questioning. Am I depressed? I must be depressed. This hurts so bad. How can this hurt so bad? We're looking for some way to take the pain of caring and to bring it back into the mind's definition. I'm depressed. This has to be depression. It can't be compassion. Compassion is supposed to be loving, and I just feel hurt all the time. Because the other way we move when we're afraid of love is cynicism. Cynicism is fear of love. And I don't know if some of you have seen, I mean, you've all seen it, but whether you recognize it or not, the TV caring. I saw it a few nights ago when it was talking about, I can't remember the incident, but it was some very heartfelt news story about a daughter, a young girl, dying. And the newscasters were, you know, isn't this just a difficult story? Yes, it's so difficult. And so now we're going to take a break, and then toothpaste commercial. And then immediately after the series of commercials, how'd the Sonics do? And, there was no... It was just, they're playing forth the drama. It was milking the drama. It was TV caring. And we've learned how to TV care, really. Our heart, and that's why so many of us, have a deeper yearning for this. And I don't know whether the deeper yearning is to the point yet where you'll be devoted to love. Because that's what's required. To spiritually grow open-heartedly, we will have to share in the pain of others in true caring. If there was a way out of it, I would have found it because I've searched everywhere. I don't like that path. It hurts. And we use practices to intimate this genuine caring. But the genuine caring is available if we stop fearing and if and when we're willing to trust love. But most of us have to ratchet it, it's like one foot at a time here, one toe at a time. And so we get involved in practices which are not in any way inappropriate. They are appropriate. They give us a growing sense of safety in the subject. But it only takes an instant to be fully arrived. It only takes an instant for the totality of you, which is already here, by definition, to be here legitimately. It only takes a second to love. And all it requires is non-resistance. Not prolonged practice. We have to release ourselves from what we object, from all of our objections, from all of our fears, and trust again. You're in Thailand and there are a lot of scorpions around. What are you going to do? You chose to come. See, that's what the Dharma provides. It gives us that. It gives us opportunity after opportunity after opportunity after opportunity to do just that. That's what all Dharma talks, practices, everything. That's the pointing. That's the direction. That's the water course way. And so let's at least be willing to move in that direction. To take our life and to look at where the uncomfortableness lies, where the fear resides, and test the waters once more. Love will not validate you, but it will validate the totality. Okay. So am I so important anyway, Are we so important? Are we so meaningful to the world? Do we have to keep looking over the shoulder of God to make sure he's doing or her doing it correctly? Cross your T there. Can there be some kind of relaxation here? And ease? And rest? Is there another dimension so maybe we can sit for a minute or two?